Whether or not you supported it at the time, and the numbers would suggest you did, you probably remember the first government plane of Syrian refugees arriving in Canada.
This week, Canadian airports will be the sites of some first tentative steps in Canada. Refugees who have fled Syria are slowly beginning to arrive now.
This is a wonderful night where we get to show not just a plane load of new Canadians what Canada's all about, but we get to show the world how to open our hearts and welcome in people who are fleeing extraordinarily difficult situations.
Justin Trudeau's brand made a virtue of Canadians welcoming, accepting, and supporting refugees from around the world and particularly from Syria. In the months after Donald Trump won the 2016 American election with anti-immigrant rhetoric, Trudeau leaned further into this strategy. You may remember a famous hashtag, Welcome to Canada, and all the victory laps the Liberal government and, to be fair, many of us, took in reaction to the global praise we received for our efforts. That was a while ago, though. And as much as many of us might like to hold on to our image of good-hearted, always welcoming, world-beloved Canada, it's time to ask some questions. Have we lived up to our promise to those refugees? We sponsored them and publicly welcomed them. We gave them jackets and a year's worth of sponsorship. And how have they fared? Is that image of the welcoming Canadian really still who we are? A recent survey found for the first time that 40% of us believe there are too many visible minorities coming to Canada. Included in that 40% are 71% of conservatives. The conservatives are currently leading federal election polls by a healthy margin. So have we changed? Or has this sentiment always been here? And finally, what is it like for people fleeing their home for a better life to arrive in Canada today? I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings, and this is The Big Story. Nicholas Kyung is the Toronto Star's immigration reporter. He has been in touch with many Syrian refugees since they arrived in this country. Do you remember back in January of 2017, the hashtag Welcome to Canada tweets from Justin Trudeau?
Who can't?
Yeah. What did that symbolize back then, and what kind of story did that spark about Canada and immigration?
And I think that was a different time and era. Trump was just elected, and his I think it put Trudeau, you know, in the very contrasting image. And I think, you know, he felt the need to distinguish himself from, you know, our leader south of the border with all these, you know, irregular, what we call quote-unquote irregular migrants crossing the border. You know, I think he wanted to stick to his image of being, you know, a young liberal leader, progressive, you know. I think that's what behind, you know, his tag on Twitter.
In the last couple of years, has Canada in reality walked that talk when it comes to welcoming refugees and immigrants?
Definitely. Initially, we did. Right after the Liberals were elected, I'm sure you remember the image of Ellen Curdy, the Syrian child who lying face down, dead, you know, on a beach in Turkey.
Yeah.
And I think that image actually touched the hearts of Canadians. And, you know, and then we had after 10 years of the Harper government, whose government had always been criticized as being anti-refugees, anti-immigrants because of all these changes they made on the immigration policies. So it was very refreshing at the beginning to have a new leader who's actually friendly to refugees and open the doors to refugees. And I think, you know, that actually he received, Trudeau received a lot of accolades from, you know, a lot of Canadians. But then, you know, something out of his control, you know, no one anticipated that, was the election of Trump and the kind of implications of his travel bans, his anti-immigration immigrants, especially to do with the undocumented, including the
right.
Dreamers, that actually driven a lot of undocumented, you know, migrants south of the border to cross the border into the States. And I think, you know, it started off being just trickling in, you know, in Manitoba and a little bit in Quebec. And then when the words got out and just, you know, they just coming in droves.
Yeah.
And I'm sure the Liberal government also was caught off guard by it. And then, you know, I think the sentiment changed. I was actually talking to a friend this morning about how the idea of, you know, who is a more deserving immigrants, the idea being introduced in the 10 years by Jason Kenney. I think, you know, he was the first one who introduced, you know, who is more deserving as immigrants, you know, ranking, you know, permanent residents, skilled immigrants, you know, would be above, you know, someone trying to be sponsored under family reunification. And then you have the real refugees and the bogus refugees. And I think, you know, that concept actually was introduced. And then, you know, now, you know, we would hear, you know, even refugees criticizing the regular migrants crossing from the States as queue jumper, and advocates also criticizing. I think, you know, it's very interesting to see how that legacy of dividing even among migrant groups and advocates.
Are we seeing a change in more than just perception? Have the Liberals made any recent changes to that policy?
Oh, definitely. And I think what is interesting, last Monday, I'm sure you'll remember, somewhere buried in their 392 or 97-page federal budget, there were some changes about how to close that loophole in what we call the Safer Country Agreement. For those, you know, audience who are not familiar with what the Safe Third Country Agreement is, it basically bans any asylum seekers from seeking protection in, you know, if they first arrived in the States, they cannot, you know, just cross the border into Canada and make an asylum claim, and vice versa. But there's a provision in that agreement that actually, if, you know, a migrant actually crossed between of the official ports of entry, meaning that if they manage to sneak in to the country, then they're not bound by that restrictions. So that's what we are seeing when the word got out. You know, a lot of people knowing that someone successfully managed to get through the border, you know, some would say irregularly, or some, you know, conservatives would call them illegally, causing significant change in the policy in the last 2 years. You know, you've heard a lot of criticisms from advocates, you know, just general public, you know, viewing that, you know, all of a sudden, are we closing down a border like what the States, you know, Trump has done, you know, between Mexico and the U.S.? Like, is it a demarcation of a new trend, you know, or is just, you know, an election maneuver, you know, before the October election? We don't know. Like, we'll have to see.
I feel like there's kind of a contradiction in terms of the way we like to think of ourselves and hold up. I know I've done it myself. I've got many friends and acquaintances who do it, who really treasure that idea of Canada being incredibly welcoming to immigrants and refugees from all over the world. Mm-hmm. And then you start to see these signs that not only are the loopholes being closed, but public perception has shifted. And I wonder, in your work, have the people you talk to who are refugees or who work with refugees, have they seen the same kind of welcoming that we like to talk about on the ground in practice?
You know, it's interesting, you know, when we talk about public opinions, you know, the issues about discrimination and racism, you know, I think it has never gone away.
Mm-hmm.
But I just feel now with the issue over the irregular migration from the States, with, you know, all the nationalist movements in we're seeing in Europe, south of the border in the States. And, you know, we had last year we had a mayoral candidate. I'm not going to name her because I think it's a, you know, I just don't want her name be heard,
mm-hmm.
you know, running for mayor as a mayor of the city. I think, you know, it's just a matter of, you know, in all these public polls, people just become more vocal. You know, we have always heard about, you know, Canadians being polite, being nice. You know, I came as an, you know, immigrant myself, you know, when I was 23 years old. That was like a long time ago. As a newcomer, you know, you always could feel it, you know, from body language, from, you know, it doesn't have to be verbally, you know, someone is being discriminatory, but you just being more sensitive, more aware. And I just feel those sentiments always there. But, you know, it's just a matter of one, I think the volume of the volume, meaning the number of immigrants coming,
right,
the source country they're coming from, meaning, you know, they're more, you know, migration, global migration, the movement always from developing country to developed countries, people looking for, you know, better life, not a worse life, right?
Yeah.
So the source country, meaning that, you know, the major source would be from Africa, from the Middle East, and from Asia. And I think that, you know, racial combination and the volume definitely, you know, are contributing factors to promote that kind of nationalist, populist movement, Plus, you know, you have, you know, politicians playing conquer and divide. My feeling is those sentiments just coming above surface now, instead of being, you know, hidden. You would hear, you know, even politicians talking about the idea of political correctness. And I think, you know, even back in the 90s, you know, those would be considered like fringe opinions. But now, yeah. you know, it's publicly debated. I'm all for public dialogues on, you know, how politically correct should Canadians be. But I just feel the way, you know, you talk about these issues, you know, you have to be really careful. You know, you don't want to, you know, see what has happened in Europe happening in Canada, because we are way more diverse in our population. If we have that kind of divisive emotions among us, we would be in bigger trouble than just, you know, one community against another, because it would be like a chaos, like many communities against many different communities.
In the 2 and some years since we really started welcoming a large amount of Syrian refugees, what have we seen in terms of what their lives are like, what issues they've faced, how well they've settled in Canada? Because I feel like we heard a lot about them when they first arrived and we welcomed them with open arms, as we love to tout. And then obviously there's a whole process that happens away from the cameras.
We actually, at the Star, we actually did, last year was the third anniversary of this settlement, of the first wave of Syrians arriving. And we did, you know, do, you know, a series of stories to look at how well they have integrated or they have not integrated. And one of the, you know, in general, like I think my observation is, you know, just like any migrants, you know, you have the issues about adjustment to a culture, to a new language, about finding jobs, finding housing. It is no different from, you know, if you and I would move from Toronto to Quebec or to, right. I think Quebec would be a better example because of the language difference. But the thing is, you know, we would have, you know, the, you know, already a social support network of friends and sometimes families to help us out. But I think for refugees, you know, the big difference is they don't come here by choice. I remember when, you know, initially when the Syrians arrived, like we just interviewed a lot of Syrians and, you know, they never heard of Canada before. They didn't want to come. And if they had a choice, some of them actually wanted to go back in 6 months when the war was over.
Really?
That's what they told me. But for a lot of immigrants, you know, I think, especially economic immigrants, they come here by choice. They come here with the skills. They wanted to make a better life, if not for themselves, because we heard about, you know, doctors driving cabs phenomenon before. But at least, you know, for the second generations, they wanted them to succeed, to have a good education. But, you know, that's by choice. You know, they always have the choice to go back. But for refugees, they don't have that choice.
What kinds of resources are available to them? And one of the reasons we're talking to you today is because there's a story out of Calgary of a 9-year-old.
Where's that story?
Yeah, of a 9-year-old Syrian refugee girl who took her own life. And she was being bullied at school, which is, I mean, on the one hand is something that not just refugee kids face. But I wonder what kind of resources are available for those folks who might be going through that. Because I can only imagine what that would be like in combination with trying to integrate and, you know, a language barrier and everything else.
Yep. Before I answer your questions, I just want to, you know, talk about a little bit of the terminology of refugees.
Okay.
Because I think there's a lot of, you know, confusion among the public. You know, they think refugees are refugees are refugees, but they're actually different categories of refugees. You know, when we talk about the Syrian refugees that, you know, a lot of community groups have sponsored in the last few years, we call those sponsored refugees, meaning that they already got the designation by UNHCR, the UN, United Nations Refugee Agency, certify them as legit refugees. And they had to go through medical clearances and security clearances by Canadian officials before they are being resettled as permanent residents in Canada, meaning that when they arrive, they're already permanent residents.
Right.
But I think sometimes people confuse them with refugees who come across the U.S. border. We call those, technically illegally as asylum seekers, because their status still undecided, meaning they still need to go before a refugee judge to present their claims, why they need Canada's protection, and and then there will be, you know, a positive or negative decision. So there are different services afforded to, you know, the Syrians who are sponsored to Canada and those asylum seekers who actually just come here for protection. When we talk about, you know, the Syrians, they're, you know, the kind of social and community services available to them is no different from, you know, any, you know, if someone come as an architect or a lawyer, they're eligible to any, you know, housing services, counseling, including mental health counseling, employment counseling, and they get helped, you know, to arrange the kids to go to school, to enroll the kids in schools, and everything that you can think of, you know, and for your initial settlement. But when we talk about the asylum seekers, because, you know, their status in Canada is still uncertain, so there's very limited government services actually available to them. Yes, the kids can go to school. They can apply for a work permit to work in Canada. But before, you know, there's an outcome, you know, whether they've been accepted as refugee or not, they would not be able to, let's say, to get, you know, housing support or, you know, some of the other services. Right. Yep. So, it depends on, you know, which group we're talking about. You know, there's, you know, again, you know, it comes down to that different labelings of refugees and migrants.
When you talk to people who don't know much about your line of work and find out, what are some of the biggest questions you get or myths that you have to tackle? Because I feel like this is an issue that everybody has an opinion on right now, and it's really nuanced.
You know, I can tell you that covering immigration and refugees probably is the most polarizing beat in the newsroom. And there's no gray area. People either for it or against it. You know, for every story that, you know, I filed in the paper, run in the paper, somehow people can find a way to criticize, you know, and you know, you have like, you're a bleeding liberal, you have a bleeding heart, and, you know, about, you know, being a left-wing propaganda, all these stories. But some of the biggest myth is really interesting. That has been going around for, got to be like 18 years now, that refugees, you know, refugee claimants, they actually could get, you know, over $3,000 of government benefits a month, which is a myth, because a long time ago, 18 years ago, I did a story about government-sponsored refugees, and they receive a startup check of, you know, to cover the first month, last month rent, right, and other benefits, but it's only one time. You know, I have forgotten about the amount. And then each month, they would, from then onward, they would receive a welfare check of, I think at the time it was $570. And then words got out and, you know, spread on the internet that these people were, you know, these people were referring to refugee claimants. Actually, they got, you know, over $3,000 taxpayers' dollars from UNI every month. Instead of, like, you know, didn't say it was a huge portion of that was a one-time benefits. And then, you know, even today, I just still, you know, got to see those those information recycled online. And you know, another big one would be, how come, you know, the Q jumping thing is huge.
Q jumping is a huge one.
Yeah, but people don't realize that, you know, these are different programs. You know, being sponsored to Canada is processed, you know, by a different unit within Immigration Canada. You know, the asylum seekers, they are being dealt with by the Immigration and Refugee Board. Immigration programs are handled by, and again, you know, immigration units within immigration. So it's not like, you know, I cannot jump the queue because I'm not in the same queue. How can I jump the queue?
Yeah.
So it's just very interesting. But then, you know, you have all these, you know, the for example, immigration applicants who got caught up in the backlog would complain, how come refugees are treated better with more respect than, you know, by the government than mm-hmm. me, who actually come here with my skills, eager to contribute to your economy? It's, you know, very fascinating, those kind of comments and criticisms.
When you talk to refugees and asylum seekers these days, how aware are they that they are the most divisive issue in the upcoming election, potentially? That there's this huge conversation going on around them?
I think there is, you know, not enough awareness. I think, you know, one is a lot of them, they're just so occupied by mm-hmm. getting the protection in the process, you know, talking to their lawyers, trying to collect, you know, a police report from Hungary or from Czech Republic to prepare for the claims. Like, I'm talking about the more recent arrivals.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, those who have been here a bit longer, they're occupied by, you know, the next step is the settlement, the housing, you know, how their kids are doing in school. maybe some of them have to do with post-traumatic stress disorder, you know, with some mental health challenges, depression, you know, that was set in after, you know, the first 12 to 18 months. And, you know, I've probably, you know, Canadian politics would be the last thing they have in mind, to be honest. But they do, you know, if you talk to any refugees, I think, especially those already being granted status in Canada, they always, you know, praise about how grateful they are here to be given a new life, how safe their kids would feel. You know, if you talk to, you know, refugees who are here, you know, LGBTQ refugees, they'll talk about, you know, how happy they are to be able to be themselves. You know, they only have good things to talk about Canada. And they don't take their new lives for granted. I think that's the best part about, you know, sometimes, you know, no offense to Canadians, but there are the sense of, you know, talking about the sense of entitlement. Sometimes I think, you know, maybe Canadians may have a stronger sense of entitlement than some of these refugees who don't take what they receive for granted easily.
Do they feel the ground shifting? I mean, we've mentioned new polls and new campaigns that show that Canadians in general are starting to take a harder line on immigration and refugees. Do they feel that that's happening?
Definitely. For example, last week, the Ontario budget actually completely stripped any funding for legal services for immigrants and refugees. So I went out to talk to some advocates and talk to refugee claimants who actually got caught up by the funding cuts. You know, definitely they could feel the ground has shifted a little bit, that, you know, is not as open, as friendly during the time when we opened the doors for the Syrians, especially when you talk to, because, you know, during the border crossing, some people call crisis from the States, I did talk to a lot of people who crossed the borders and why they're here and what their circumstances were, their feeling towards Canada. And I've been in touch with some of them too. What is interesting is, you know, when they first arrived, you know, they were so grateful, but slowly and slowly, you know, especially the ones who are English speaking, for example, a Nigerian family that I've kept in touch with, because they do look, you know, watch the media, the TV, and they understand the language. So they are able to observe, you know, the trends, the changes. They would tell me, you know, when they first got here, you know, it's an open doors policy. And they talked about that tweet by Trudeau.
Right.
And then now, you know, with all this, you know, changes, they do feel that, you know, there is a shift in, they don't see it necessarily as Canadians' attitudes to immigrants shifted, but more like in terms of at least from the policy, government policy perspective, it has shifted.
How important is it for Canada to keep that image that Trudeau showed the rest of the world with that tweet, whether or not, and I'm saying this, whether or not we actually live up to it on the ground, but the fact that that's what the rest of the world holds up Canada as.
And I think you would get a different response if you talk to people in Alberta.
Yeah.
Versus, you know, somewhere in the Paris versus the rest of Canada, or, you know, in Quebec, you know, we all heard about the Bill 21, the bill to about secularism.
Yep.
I think, you know, you would get a different response if you talk to, you know, different people from different provinces.
But that image is out there. Like, that is not, I'm not
I think
saying,
for outsiders, yes.
Yeah, for people
for Canadians, we
Canada.
Know, like, which is more, you know, which provinces tend to be more conservative.
Yeah, inside Canada, it's quite divisive, for sure. Yeah. But, like, I mean, that is, you see all those tweets and Facebook posts from Americans every time Trump does something horrible on immigration or whatever that says, you know what, Canada's not like this.
It is interesting. I think in the recent, at least 2 months, I've seen in different American publications, including newspapers. I think there was a story in New York Times as well about, you know, the shift. You know, they mentioned about Trudeau's tweets,
right,
and the you know, what was happening recently, you know, in terms of his policies. You know, they made a great big feature about the changes we, you know, from, you know, buried in the federal budget announcement,
like
about
the
close the loopholes in the third countries. And slowly and slowly, you know, because the Star, we do have like an immigration Facebook group, like where we have members from, you know, across the border or around the world. You started to see, sometimes, you know, I see, you know, the tweets from, you know, people that I follow or they follow me about those sentiments. Like slowly, you know, I think people outside of Canada started to notice those changes as well. Is it good? Is it bad? Like, I don't know. Like, I can't judge, but definitely I think people notice those policy changes. But what I would like, you know, personally, would like to people to see is the context of we are having an election coming. Those right. policy changes are driven by politics and just how ugly politics can be. And, you know, and I hope hopefully people would see that, you know what, we could blame politicians, but just don't blame those people, the vulnerable people who need our protection, who just wants a better life, a safer life.
Thanks, Nicholas.
My pleasure.
Nicholas Kyung, immigration reporter for the Toronto Star. That was The Big Story. For more from us, we're at the same place we always are, thebigstorypodcast.ca and frequencypodcastnetwork.com. You can also find us on your social media at Frequency Pods, on Twitter, on Facebook, on Instagram, and at The Big Story FPN on Twitter if it's just us you want. If you feel like giving us a rating or a review, we would very much appreciate it. We are in all your favorite podcast apps. Just open it up. Let us know what you think. Thanks for listening. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. We'll talk tomorrow.
In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together. We were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a 6-part podcast from CBC. Available now.